This is the story of Harold Prince, unquestionably the most dominant producer-director in the musical theatre today. He's presented such Broadway super shows as The Little Night Music, Cabaret, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Fiddler on the Roof, Company, Damn Yankees, The Pajama Game, and West Side Story. Prince's career began with a hit, and his next four musicals were hits as well. A meteoric start.
When you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, if the spit hits the fan, you got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected. You're home with your own. When company's expected, you're well protected. Then you are set with a capital J, which you'll never forget till they cart you away. When you're a jet, you... Now, I know Tony like I know me, and I guarantee you can count him in.
In, out. Let's get cracking.
Where are you going to find Bernardo?
At the dance tonight at the gym.
But the gym's neutral territory.
Well, I'm going to make nice with him. I'm only going to challenge him.
Great, Daddy-O.
So everybody dress up sweet and sharp. Meet Tony and me at 10. And walk tall.
We always walk tall.
We're just the greatest.
When you're a jet, you're the top cat in town. You're the gold medal kid with the heavyweight crown. When you're a jet, you're the swinginest thing. Little boy, you're a man. Little man, you're a king. The jets are in gear. Our cylinders are clinking. The shots will steer clear. Cause every Puerto Rican's a lousy chicken. Here comes the jets like a bat. Now the hell someone gets in our way. Someone don't feel so well. Here comes the jets with a world death aside. Better go underground, better run, better hide. We're drawing the line, so keep your noses hidden. We're hanging a sign, since visitors forbidden. And we ain't kidding. Here comes the jets, yeah. And we're gonna be every last morning gang on the whole barking street, on the whole ever-mother.
Harold Prince, or if you're in the theatre, Hal Prince, or even Prince Hal, describes his family as privileged, upper-middle, lower-rich-class Jewish. They're also a theatre-loving family, and as Prince recalls...
I went to theatre a lot as a kid, with my parents, and with friends, and alone. I mean, I went to theatre alone to Saturday matinees in New York as early as 10 or 12. So that I went to the old Empire Theatre when I was 8, I guess. 6 or 8, I saw Orson Welles, who was then 21, in the Mercury Theater productions, most notable of which was a modern dress version of Julius Caesar, Mussolini-inspired. I saw Robert Morley as Oscar Wilde. I don't know, I must have been about 10 then. I saw a lot of things that kids don't see, and the things that kids see I saw didn't care much for. White Horse Inn, The American Way, that kind of thing. Mostly what I liked were things that I've remembered ever since. I saw Pepe Schildkraut, and I saw Le Gallienne, and I saw the Oliviers when they first came over and did Romeo and Juliet and went bankrupt. I don't know how old they were, but I was pretty young at the time. Then I saw them come back and do Caesar and Cleopatra and Antony and Cleopatra. I went to theater a lot, and I always wanted to do what I'm doing, and I'm doing it.
From the age of 12, Prince wrote plays. Then, when he was 16, he won an award as the best actor at the University of Pennsylvania. Now, this didn't go to his head too much, though, as World War II was then on, and he was just about the only male at the college. In 1947, Prince arrived in New York, where he eventually got a job in the office of the famous writer-director-producer George Abbott. He worked as an ASM, assistant stage manager, that is, on an Abbott review called Touch and Go.
And then I went on from that to another show called Tickets, Please, and then casting a show called Call Me Madam. Anyway, I was to be the ASM on that show, and I got drafted. The Korean War started, and I was the first person drafted from New York. I went to Germany.
To Stuttgart, to be exact, where Private Prince spent many a theater-starved evening in a tatty nightclub called Maxim's, a club that was to turn up 16 years later in his show Cabaret. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. When his army service was up, Prince returned to Broadway and an ASMing job with the George Abbott musical Wonderful Town, which had in its cast Edith Adams and starred Rosalind Russell.
Oh, there's a new sensation that is going around, going around, going around, going around. A simple little ditty that got a sweep in the town, sweep in the town, sweep in the town. A doo doo, a doo doo, a doo 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 doo. They call it the wrong note bird. They got a little twist that simply drives you insane, drives you insane, drives you insane, drives you insane, because you find you never get it out of your brain, out of your brain, out of your brain. They call it the wrong note bird.
Funny hop, turkey trot, give me the wrong note bird.
Please play that lovely wrong. Because they're wrong notes. Just makes me do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-wow. That note is such a strong note. It makes me rick-rick-tick, rick-rick-tick-tacky.
Rick-ricky-wick-rick-ricky-wick-wacky.
Don't play that rightful light note. Because they're right notes. Just makes me blah-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah. Give me that new and blue note. And sister, watch my throat. Watch my nuts.
It was because of Wonderful Town that Hal Prince got the chance to launch himself on a producing career with the Pajama Game. How exactly did it happen? Prince isn't all that certain.
When you start in theater, any career, I think, it's all pie in the sky. It's all dreams of glory. You can't lose because you don't know what the odds are. And it's all sort of joyful. It's only as you grow older and you know what the odds were that you shudder in fear. So, in fact, you have these incredible dreams of glory, and you go ahead and work. You can't imagine failing, and you succeed. It's all sort of storybook nonsense. And Pajama Game was that. We decided to make a musical of something called 7.5 Cents, and we did. A lot of struggle involved, raising money. All the struggles are jolly in some strange way. What have you got to lose? You're 20, I was 23. Nothing. And resistance on every side. People didn't want to write the music for it, the book for it, choreograph it. So in fact, because nobody wanted to, we had a new composer, a new lyricist, a new choreographer, Bobby Fosse, knew almost everything. It all worked out. But my memory of it now is more in the area of fantasy than reality.
Well, let's clear away some of the fantasy. Not too much, just enough to see how the Pajama Game started. The initiator was Frederick Brisson, who luckily produced a highly forgettable murder film starring his wife, Rosalind Russell. It was a mystery with a theatrical background, and as Brisson confesses...
I got the itch because my wife had gotten the itch to return to Broadway. So when she was doing a musical of a film that she had made called My Sister Eileen on Broadway, the title of the musical was My Wonderful Town, and I had at that time optioned a book that I wanted to do as a film called 8.5 Cents.
Wait a minute. Didn't Hal Prince say the book was called 7.5 Cents? Oh, Prince was right, but of course film men like Brisson are trained to think big. Here Hal explains how the book came to his notice.
The stage manager, whom I assisted, was a fellow named Bobby Griffith, and we decided we would produce. And during the year that we stage managed Wonderful Town, we spoke of looking for property, and we found one day, a book called 7.5 Cents. He found it, and I read it. And we applied for the rights, and we purchased the rights. And subsequently, we interested Abbott in directing and co-authoring it, and we went from there.
And mention of George Abbott takes us back to Frederick Brisson and his...
8.5 Cents, which subsequently George Abbott suggested would make a marvelous musical. And I liked the idea, and it was the first musical that I did on Broadway. When I decided to do the musical, George Abbott asked me if I would take in his stage manager, which was Bob Griffith, And I said I'd be delighted to because I liked Bobby, and Abbott had always looked for the proper opportunity for Bobby to get the right break. And then Bobby is the one that asked if he could bring in his assistant, who was Hal Prince, and of course I said yes. So the two of them came in, and it was a joint effort on the part of the three of us.
Now add two more, those new songwriters Hal Prince mentioned. They came to Pajama Game with a hit song to their credit, the Tony Bennett 2 million seller Rags to Riches. Their names were Jerry Ross and Richard Adler.
The first time I remember I ever met Hal was when he came to our little office on West 55th Street, the office that Jerry Ross and I had, to hear the songs that we had written for Pajama Game. We had a trial period of 1 month to write four songs in. If they liked the four songs, then they would put us on to write the rest of the score. And that was either the first or second time that I met Hal.
First or second, the important thing was he got the job. And Adler and Ross came through with a very good score.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes. Love never made a fool of you. You used to be too wise. Hey there. Flying cloud, though she won't throw a crumb to you, you think someday she'll come to you. Better forget her, her with her nose in the air. She has you dancing on a string, break it. And she won't care. Will you take this advice I hand you like a brother? Or are you not seeing things too clear? Are you not seeing things too clear? Are you just too far gone to hear? Is it all going in one ear and out the other?
To choreograph Pajama Game, the management chose Bob Fosse, as Hal Prince said. Today, of course, Fosse is the virtuoso director of hit shows like Pippin, Sweet Charity, and Chicago, not to mention such films as Cabaret and Lenny. But in 1953, he was just a dancer with precious little Broadway experience of any kind.
I'd only played in one show that ran for about 5 weeks on Broadway. Then somebody saw me and gave me a screen test, and I got what was called a 7-year contract, which I only fulfilled about a year and a half of. I never thought I was very good in films, to be honest with you. But also, in those days, there were just so many films, and they would just put you in whatever part that was available. Sometimes it would be a big part, sometimes it would be a small part. And you did whatever film they told you to do. You had no choice whatsoever. The first picture I did there, I had a very big part, opposite Debbie Reynolds and Gower and Marge Champion were in the film. The second picture I did, I had a slightly smaller part. And the third picture I did there was even smaller, so I figured that I had better leave.
One of Bob Fosse's Hollywood films had been Kiss Me, Kate, in which he danced with Carol Haney, who was doubling as Gene Kelly's assistant because she just couldn't get enough work as a dancer. Fosse suggested her for the role of Gladys, the passionate bookkeeper in Pajama Game. She was a sensation, stopping the show with Fosse's tricky steam heat routine, as well as with the funniest of all tangos.
I know a dark, secluded place, a place where no one knows your face. A glass of wine, a fast embrace. It's called Hernando's Hideaway. Ole. All you see are silhouettes, and all you hear are castanets, and no one cares how late it gets. Not at Hernando's Hideaway. Ole. Or any any place you go. You'll meet your Uncle Max and everyone you know. But if we go to the spot that I am thinking of, you will be free to gaze at me and talk of love. Just knock three times and whisper low that you and I were sent by Jove. Then strike a match and you will know you're in Fernando's hideaway. Oy.
Hey, buddy, this ain't Poopsie.
I know a dark, secluded place, a place where no one knows your face. A glass of wine, a fast embrace. It's called Fernando's Hideaway. Ole!
Uncle Max and everyone you know. But if you go to the spot that I am thinking of,
you will be free
to gaze at me
and talk of love.
Of course, after Pajama Game opened on Broadway, the stage managing days of Hal Prince and Bobby Griffith were gone forever, and Ross and Adler were no longer just popular songwriters. Adler recalls the first clash he had with Prince.
It wasn't with Hal alone, it was with Hal and Bobby, getting four extra musicians into the pit in the string section to kind of fill out the sound, just for the first 6 weeks of the run in New York and the opening, and they were very much against it because the stringent budgetary requirements of this particular production. They had very little money. And I was interested in having what I considered to be the right sound, and we had quite a blow-up about it. But finally, they gave in to me, and we had four extra fiddles in the string section, and it did help, I think, quite a bit. And then at the end of a certain period of time, they reduced the size of the orchestra to what it had initially been.
Griffith and Prince still had a lot of rapport with their songwriters, though, so much that they signed them up immediately for another show. Like Pajama Game, Damn Yankees was based on a novel. Also, like Pajama Game, the director and co-author was again George Abbott, and the co-producer was once more Frederick Brisson, who says of Damn Yankees...
It was entirely on baseball, and it was called The Year the Yankees Lost the Pennant, the book was. And it's a really strange thing. You know, in America, everybody is really baseball nuts. Cricket is a wonderful game in England, but I think there are more baseball nuts in America than there are cricket nuts in England. And the show was magnificently successful. It started off slowly, though, which was rather a shock to us, but it did really run its full length, which was about 3.5 years, and made a lot of money. But when it came to making the film, which was an excellent film, the reception was not half as good, but I presume that's because around the world, people do not know or care enough about baseball.
Of course, Tab Hunter playing the male lead might have had something to do with it, too. The star of both stage and screen versions of Damn Yankees was the brilliant dancer Gwen Verdon. Her experiences during the out-of-town tour of the show led her to make a highly practical suggestion which might well render such tryouts less traumatic.
I think they ought to have an analyst travel, because between tearful actors and actresses and irate composers, I mean, it's madness on the road, it really is. They felt that I had not enough to do in the show. So then they had the choice of cutting numbers that other people did, which naturally did not make them very happy. And that's when they wrote the number, Little Brains, Little Talent. Then they decided that they should take out the second baseball ballet, not the big ballet that remained in the show, but the second one, and put in the mambo. Who's got the pain when they do the mambo? So all these decisions were made in New Haven and Boston. And those are major changes.
Who's got the pain when they do the mambo? Who's got the pain when they go flirt? Who's got the pain when they do the mambo? I don't know who. Do you? Who needs a pill when they do the mambo? Who needs a pill when they go flirt? Who needs a pill when they do the mambo? I don't know who. Do you? Someone must be sick with the heat or stepping on everyone's feet. What if everyone's feeling okay? Why don't they just say away when the music carries them away? Who's got the pain when they do the mambo? Who's got the pain when they go? Who's got the pain when they do the mambo? I don't know who. Do you?
Damn Yankees received rave notices from the Broadway critics, but during its first month did worryingly slow business. Prince and Company decided it was the American public's fabled indifference to shows with a baseball theme and quickly changed the advertisements. What used to be a picture of Gwen Verdon looking cute in a baseball uniform suddenly became one showing her looking sexy in a leotard. Result? Long queues at the box office and a healthy run of 1,019 performances.
Is there a doctor in the house? Is there a doctor in the house? If there's a doctor in the house, point him out, for there is an element of doubt. Who's got the pain when they do the mambo? Who's got the pain when they go hurt? Who needs a pill when they do the mambo? Who needs a pill when they go hurt?
Damn Yankees gave Gwen Verdon her first starring role in a musical. But what does she remember of Prince in those days?
He just seemed like a giggly boy to me. I mean, everybody associated with the show, I think, was, with the exception of George Abbott, who must have been 60-something, and Bobby Griffiths, who was probably 50-something. Everybody else was 24 to 28 years old, composers and all. Richard Adler and Jerry Ross. Now, they were very young boys.
And sadly, Jerry Ross, with only two Broadway shows behind him and a glittering career ahead of him, suddenly died of a lung ailment. Another new songwriter, Bob Merrill, was to write the songs for the next musical produced by Prince, Griffith and Brisson. It was called New Girl in Town and was based on the Broadway play by Eugene O'Neill, Anna Christie, dealing with a prostitute's efforts to make a new life with a naive Irish stoker who's unaware of her past. Prince wasn't mad about the idea of a musical Anna Christie, and he only agreed to do it because it had been a whole year since Damn Yankees and he was feeling broody. However, he was very enthusiastic about Gwen Verdon playing Anna, feeling it would give her the chance to display the considerable power of her acting. After some difficulty, he persuaded George Abbott, who was directing the show and writing the book, and she was cast in the part. At the outset, it was agreed that although Gwen Verdon was a dancing star, New Girl in Town was one show in which she would not, must not, dance. Anna Christie was a world-weary, defeated cynic, and dancing would be totally out of character, although she would sing.
They talk about the feeling, how something in your rings, you fly around the ceiling, 'cause love can give you wings. The ringing is a lie. I didn't learn to fly. If that was love, love hurts an awful lot. Unless somebody cares once, they say it's awful sad. I stumbled down the stairs once, it didn't hurt as bad. If love can give you wings, something in your sings, then maybe love just wasn't what I got. If that was love, it hurt an awful lot.
New Girl in Town, Out of Town, was a mess. During the tryout, nothing but nothing went right. So desperation galloped in the door, and the no-dancing-for-Anna resolve went out the window. Soon Gwen Verdon was doing so much dancing, she needed not one, not two, but three understudies. A compromise has no place in the arts, and New Girl in Town has no place in Hal Prince's affections. The show ran for a year, but as far as he's concerned, it was a successful failure. Hardly a phrase you'd ever use to describe his next production.
I like to be in America. Okay, by me in America. Everything's free in America. What is more free in America?
I like the city of San Juan. I know a boat you can get on.
Hundreds of flowers in full bloom.
Hundreds of people in each room.
Automobile in America. Chromium steel in America. Wire for free in America. Very big deal in America.
The lineup of creative talent on the masthead of West Side Story was impressive. Music by Leonard Bernstein, lyrics by Stephen Sondheim, book by Arthur Lawrence, directed and choreographed by Jerome Robbins. As for Harold Prince...
We did it, I guess, in 57. It was a German idea in the heads of its initial creators. In 45, so it was 12 years. And it was then to be a musical about a Jewish boy and a Catholic girl in New York. In the 12 years, they didn't work on it. They just talked about it. And they probably worked on it from 55 on, or 54, it became more specifically about social conditions in New York, and it became about Puerto Ricans. A producer named Carol Crawford was to do it. She had had a failure that year with Candide, which Bernstein had done. And so, at the last minute, she decided not to do West Side. And Sondheim, who's a good friend of mine, told me the bad news, and I grabbed it with my partner, Bobby Griffith. I was so excited to get it, I can't tell you.
Sondheim, who was making his Broadway debut with West Side Story, wasn't exactly indifferent to the Prince takeover either.
Hal was a friend of mine, and he had heard the material before, and though he had rejected it 2 years earlier, he decided that the material had been improved enough in the intervening 2 years to take a chance on it, and in those days it was quite a chance.
In fact, it was a massive chance, according to most Broadway's self-styled experts. Before Prince came on the scene, just about everybody told Bernstein and Sondheim and Jerry Robbins that a musical full of bitterness and ballet and dead bodies was clearly a kamikaze enterprise. But the very things that worried people about West Side Story were what made it successful. It was entirely untouched by the kind of panic-produced compromises that spoiled New Girl in Town for Prince. The show was entirely true to itself from the first rehearsal to the last performance. Prince's role... Well, according to Sondheim...
He is a creator. In the case of West Side Story, his major function, I think, was to keep all the creators together.
Luckily, Prince and his creators understood to a man the kind of musical play that they wanted and worked selflessly to bring about that dream. Arthur Lawrence kept ruthlessly cutting his own text to keep it terse and telling. And one day during rehearsals, he put it to the others that the show was too solemn and needed livening up. He posed an idea for a comedy number, and his suggestion was Howl Down. They all thought it sounded like a cheap, obvious crowd pleaser, but Lawrence dug in his heels until finally he got his comedy number. When West Side opened on Broadway, the critic John McClane called the song the most hilarious travesty of our times.
You gotta understand, it's just our bringing up the that gets us out of hand. Our mothers all are junkies, our fathers all are drunks. Golly Moses, naturally we're punks.
Gee, Officer Krupke, we're very upset. We never had the love that every child ought to get. We ain't no delinquents, we're misunderstood. sweet. Down inside us there is good.
There is good.
There is good. There is good. There is untapped good. Black inside, the voice of us is good.
This is such a good story.
Let me tell it to the world.
Just tell it to the judge.
Come on, judge.
Kindly judge, your honor, my parents treat me rough. With all the marijuana, they won't give me a puff. They didn't want to have me, but somehow I was had. Leaping lizards, that's why I'm so bad.
Right, Officer Krupke, you're really a square. This boy don't need a judge, he needs an analyst's care. It's just his neurosis that ought to be claimed. He's psychologically destroyed.
I'm destroyed.
We're destroyed, we're destroyed, we're the most destroyed. Like we're psychologically destroyed. Hear ye, hear ye. In the opinion of this court, this child is depraved on account of he ain't had a normal home.
Hey, I'm depraved on account of the crime.
So take him to a head shrinker.
Come on, let's go. Wait.
My father is a bastard. My mom's an SOB. My grandpa's always plastered. My grandma pushes tea. My sister wears a mustache. My brother wears a dress. Goodness gracious, that's why I'm a mess.
Yes,
Officer Krupke, you're really a slob. This boy don't need a doctor, just as good on his job. Society's played him a terrible trick. And sociologically, he's sick.
I am sick.
We are sick. We are sick. We are sick.
In my opinion, this child does not need to have his head shrunk at all. Juvenile delinquency is purely a social disease.
Hey, I got a social disease.
So take him to a social worker.
Kindly social worker, they say go earn some dough. Like be a soda jerker, which means like be a schmo. If not, I'm anti-social, I'm only anti-work. Glory, honesty, that's why I'm a jerk.
Hey, Officer Krupke, you've done it again. This boy don't need a job, he needs a year in the pen. It ain't just a question of misunderstood. Down inside him, he's so good, I'm no good.
We're no good, we're no good, we're the worst, we good. Like the best of us is no damn good.
The trouble is he's lazy, the trouble is he drinks. The trouble is he's crazy, the trouble is he stinks.
The trouble is he's growing, the trouble is he's grown. Rocky, we got troubles of our own.
Surprisingly, West Side Story didn't win any major awards, and nor did it have an extended run. The show was merely a success. And it was the film version 4 years later that was the smash hit. West Side was followed by a straight play called A Swim in the Sea, which failed out of town. And in a way, Prince was relieved. He reasoned that a first flop was a kind of theatrical baptism. The following year, Prince and Griffith decided to present a musical about New York's colorful mayor, Fiorella LaGuardia, and they signed up a newcomer named Jerry Bock to write the music. Bock wanted Sheldon Harnick to write the lyrics, but Griffith and Prince weren't sure if he was the right man for the job. To test him, they asked Harnick to write 4 lyrics strictly on spec, and he accepted. Of the 4 songs they wrote, Bock and Harnick were particularly proud of a 1917 Irving Berlin-style waltz. Harnick isn't likely to forget the night that Griffith and Prince heard the songs for the first time.
We went up to Hal's apartment and played the 4 songs. One of them they didn't like very much. One of them they didn't like at all. But the 2 of them they liked a lot, and an argument started about this 1917 waltz, which is called Till Tomorrow. Bobby Griffith loved it, and Hal happened to be looking me in the eye when I sang it, and I made the mistake of involuntarily smiling when I looked at him, so that he thought that the whole song was a put-on. He said, come on, that's a joke, that song. I said, no, it isn't. This is supposed to sound like a 1917 song. And Bobby Griffith said, it does sound like that song. Everything seemed to be hinging on this one song. And the doorbell rang, and our choreographer
Pete Gennaro came in, and Hal said, all right, now, don't say anything. Play the song. So we played the song, and Pete listened, and he said, gee, that sounds exactly like a 1917 waltz. And Hal said, you're hired.
The new musical was called Fiorello, and it won the Pulitzer Prize. LaGuardia was a short, plump, gravel-voiced, unmade bed of a man of Jewish-Italian ancestry. He was also that rarity, a completely honest politician. Another of the four songs which earned Sheldon Harnick his lyricist's job introduced the audience to the other kind of politician. A bunch of hard-bitten party bosses are discovered in the middle of a card game.
Politics or poker, which is more important?
Paraphrase.
Madam.
Little phrase, good as gold.
I'll say.
Raise your mind.
I'll call.
I'll hold.
I'll raise your back.
I think you're bluffing.
Put your money where your mouth is.
Say, I'm in.
Gentlemen, knock it off and let's get this done.
Tried like a mighty Shinkovich, I'm certain he'd run.
Mike is out, I'm afraid he just wouldn't sell. Nobody likes a candidate whose name they can't spell.
How about Dave Zimmerman?
Davey's too bright.
What about Walt Gustafson?
Walt died last night.
How about Frank Monahan?
What about George Gale?
Frank ain't a citizen, and George is in jail.
We could run Al Wallenstein.
He's only 23.
What about Ed Peterson?
You idiot, that's me!
Politics and poker, politics and poker, play for a pot, that's me.
Many songs were added to Fiorello during the show's out-of-town tryout, and turning out new numbers while on tour can be nightmarish, but not for Jerry Bock.
Once you're on the road with a play, you don't have the luxury of time. You must, by necessity, write as quickly as possible, hoping for the best, getting it orchestrated, getting it on stage, so that the actors have one or two shots at it before you determine whether it's working or not. It's all a very compressed, highly pressurized atmosphere that happily we've responded to in a positive way rather than in a defeated way.
Messrs. Prince, Griffith, and Abbott were so impressed with their songwriters' positive responses that they rehired them for their very next show. Sheldon Harnick now realizes that this wasn't too wise.
No, we made two mistakes on that. The experience of Fiorello had been so euphoric that even before we opened Fiorello, after the last song had been written and the show was about to be frozen, Bobby and Hal had bought the rights to this novel, I think Samuel Hopkins Adams, Tenderloin. And all of us just started working on that. Not enough time and thought went into it. We just plunged right in, which was the first mistake.
The second mistake was an infinitely more serious one.
The novel was about a young man from the New York slums who was fighting his way up. The novel really is about him. There's another character in the novel, the minister, who is a major character, but he's not nearly as formidable or as dominant a character as the boy. And we made the mistake of making the two characters equal in size and then hired a star, Maurice Evans, to play the minister. And that was our mistake because the minister wanted to close down the Tenderloin, which was an area which was rife with crime and prostitution and consequently disease. Unfortunately, on stage, since we weren't doing this as a Brechtian exercise, we were doing this as a high-spirited show, the minister came off as a killjoy. The scenes with the prostitutes were, as almost always happens, the most interesting and the most enjoyable. So that the minister essentially was a bore. It was hard to write songs for him. Jerry and I came up with songs like Good Clean Fun, which was a nice song, but not a world beater.
So many ways to have good, clean fun. So many games to enjoy. No earthly reason why Jack should be that dull, dull boy. Every so often we're overwhelmed. Too many things to be done. That's why it pays to have so many ways to have good, clean fun.
The basic imbalance of Tenderloin became all too clear all too soon.
We got on the road and discovered that we had a star. Couldn't cut his part down. Even if Morris had been willing to step aside, it would have meant taking a hiatus and stopping the show and studying it for 3 or 4 months and rewriting it, and nobody wanted to do that. In fact, opening night in New Haven, where we had our tryout, immediately after the show, which didn't go very well, we had a meeting, and George Abbott said to all of us, "Gentlemen, I had a concept for this show, and my concept doesn't work. Does anyone have an idea?" And up till this time in my own career, I had assumed that everybody else did their job, and I did mine. So I really hadn't studied the book, and I really wasn't aware of the problems. And I just blanched, and I thought, well, I will never allow myself to get in this position again, where I really don't know the book. And from that point on, there was so much repair work to be done that Jerry and I were practically locked in our hotel rooms constantly, and I saw very little of Hal or Bobby or George Abbott or anybody. I just did my work. And by the time we brought the show to New York, it was a much better show, but it still had that terrible central problem. And we ran about 6 months with another 2 months on the road and came close to paying off, as a matter of fact.
But it wasn't a patch on Fiorello, despite the fact that the songs were as catchy as the book was muddled. The opening number, sung by the pimps and prostitutes of New York's Tenderloin, was terrifically effective.
From 14th to 42nd Street, from 4th Avenue to the Hudson, stands the largest area of undiluted vice and corruption in the world today. People of New York City, we must close up the Tenderloin.
Why can't this damn do-gooder keep his hands off? Little old New York is plenty good enough for me. Good enough for me. Good enough for me. Little old New York is plenty good enough for me.
Keep your hands off, little old New York.
I don't want no Bible spouting, gospel shouting, preacher nosing around, drying everything up, closing everything down. Don't want no roly-poly, holy-poly, purifying the town. Not my little old New York. This town has more millions and more millions are heading right this way. This town has more millions. There are millions
After Tenderloin, Griffith and Prince presented a straight play, another failure. Prince wasn't particularly discouraged, but Griffith, older and less resilient, took it hard. There were those who felt that Bobby Griffith was holding Hal Prince back. George Abbott, for instance.
We had hits and we had road shows. And I used to have Bobby and Hal go out and work on the road shows. I mean, when they'd be going, as every production does, go sour and begin to be overplayed. And I soon discovered that Hal was very adroit, but Bobby was not. And I'd say, well, just one of you go. And Bobby said, no, we want to do it together. And he would not release his grip upon his pal. They were very close and very fond of each other. But Bobby would not release him. And, of course, I'm sure that Hal was frothing to do these things by himself, which once in a while I contrived for him.
Well, George Abbott got his wish when Stephen Sondheim contacted Prince about a show called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. Like West Side Story, it had been owned by another producer, in this case, David Merrick. But when he bowed out, Prince bowed in. And not Griffith, though. He didn't like the show. Nor did Phil Silvers, for whom it was written. He thought it was dirty and corny and old-fashioned, which, of course, was the whole point of Forum. While Prince was trying to find a suitable comedy star for the lead, Griffith suddenly collapsed and died. On his own, Prince presented a straight comedy called Take Her, She's Mine, a hit. Next came Forum, another hit, but not at first. Opening in New Haven, Connecticut, and then moving on to Washington, both audience and critical reaction was muted. In fact, one critic even suggested that Prince cut his losses and close down the show. Instead, he called for help, which arrived in the person of Jerome Robbins. His first move was to get Sondheim to write a new opening number, which Robbins then staged. This new song was first performed at the opening preview on Broadway, and it not only brought down the house, but saved the entire show. Everything that followed it went like a dream.
Playgoers, I bid you welcome. The theater is a temple, and we are here to worship the gods of comedy and tragedy. Tonight, I am pleased to announce a comedy. We shall employ every device we know in our desire to divert you. Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Something appealing, something appalling, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Nothing with kings, nothing with crowns. Bring on the lovers, liars, and clowns. Old situations, new complications, nothing portentous or polite. Tragedy tomorrow, comedy tonight. Something convulsive, something repulsive, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Something aesthetic,
something frenetic,
something for everyone, a comedy tonight.
Nothing with gods, nothing with fate.
Weighty affairs will just have to wait.
Nothing that's formal,
nothing that's normal.
No recitations to recite.
Open up the curtains. Comedy tonight.
And there, with the triumphant launching of Forum, a 964-performance hit, we take our leave of Harold Prince, producer. For next week, in the second of our three programs on him, we'll be meeting Harold Prince, producer-director, a man with such classic musicals to his credit as Cabaret.
What good is sitting alone in your room? Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Put down the knitting, the book and the broom. Time for a holiday. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Come taste the wine, come hear the band, come blow your horn so celebrating right this way. Your table's waiting. No use permitting some prophet of doom to wipe every smile away. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. And as for me, I made my mind up back in Chelsea. When I go, I'm going like Elsie. Start by admitting from cradle to tomb. Isn't that long a day? Life is a cabaret, old chum. Only a cabaret, old chum. And I love a
Michael Craig presented The American Showman, which was researched by Bill Sullivan, and this week written by Dick Vosburgh. The producer was David Raven Allen. And now, here's Benny Green.
That concludes more or less the career of the producer, Hal Prince. But that's only a fancy way of saying that the interesting stuff is just about to begin. Notice, in that what we've just been listening to, Prince has been gradually working his way up to the status of producer, but with increasing anxiety about the exposure of his flanks. By which I mean that a producer, whoever he might be, has to reach a point in the end where his fate passes over into the control of other people, the writers, the performers, the director. And that's what nagged away at Prince. In next week's episode, the second of three, on this very busy, energetic, ambitious man, we can watch him change from producer to producer/director. The idea being to gain further control over the way the end product looks and sounds. There was, however, one director that Prince seemed to be fairly comfortable with, and that was Jerome Robbins. One day, Robbins was propositioned about a new musical, and he agreed to do it if Prince was the producer. Everybody ended up agreeing, and next week we'll be able to follow the processes by which this next piece of music finally reached the stage where it was on the stage.
Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Find me a find, catch me a catch. Matchmaker, matchmaker, look through your book and make me a perfect match. Matchmaker, matchmaker, I'll bring the veil. You bring the groom, slender and pale. Bring me a ring, for I'm longing to be the envy of all I see. Make him a scholar. For Mama, make him rich as a king. For me, well, I wouldn't holler if he were as handsome as anything. Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Find me a find, catch me a catch. Night after night in the dark I'm alone. So find me a match of my own.
Fiddler on the Roof was one of the most lucrative musicals that Hal Prince was ever involved in, but it doesn't indicate the way things always went for him. There was that little business of Flora the Red Menace, a show about a pre-war progressive lady, played by Liza Minnelli, but not for long. The show folded up like an accordion after 2 weeks. Then there was a musical about Superman, which should have been a great success, but somehow wasn't quite. But if there's one production which dominates part two of our three Hal Prince programmes in the Showman series, it's the one that, again, was a show linked to the real world. Remember, we saw how Prince was involved in a musical about factory workers, and another about baseball players, and yet another about a crusading politician. Well, another Hal Prince production, which had links with reality, was the one that made a star out of an actor Prince had wanted to use before. In a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, but he'd been overruled by the rest of the production team. But by now, Hal Prince was the production team in himself, and the actor did get the part. His name was Joel Grey, and it was a moment he never forgot.
I saw the script, and there was no part. There were five very, very good songs, and I thought to myself, well, this is my Broadway debut. I am essentially an actor, and there are no lines. And I didn't want to get stuck. You know, people want to pigeonhole you and say, if you do one thing and if it works, if you're lucky enough to have it work, they want you to do it for the rest of your life. So I said, I'll be damned if I will be considered a song and dance man at this point in my life.
And that was how Joel Grey became part of the Candor and Ebb success, Cabaret. So there's a long road to travel in next week's show, and for company we'll have witnesses like Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnick, John Candor, Judy Dench, and I think most revealing of all, Hal Prince himself. Between them, they'll take us to the end of the second of three shows about one of the most influential of all the modern American showmen.
Meine Damen und Herren, Mesdames et Messieurs, Ladies and Gentlemen, and now, once again, Fräulein Sally Ball!
What good is sitting alone in your room? Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Put down the knitting, the book and the broom. Time for a holiday. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Come taste the wine. Come hear the band. Come blow your horn, start celebrating. Right this way, your table's waiting. No use permitting some prophet of doom to wipe every smile away. Life is a cabaret, oh, come to
Benny Green was looking at next week's program on Hal Prince.